Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Welcome, folks, to our extra credit episode for August 2023.
We're here at Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Today, we don't have any one specific topic we're covering.
No, for today, we are instead going to discuss a smorgasbord of topics, serve up a buffet of media observation, roll around in a trough of things we've both been reading and watching and playing over the summer.
We're just going to catch up.
Yeah.
For example, last week on the feedback show, we mentioned the graphic novel West of Sundown, co-written by our listener and friend, Aaron Campbell. I done gone and read it.
I'm sure Aaron is like, hey, I'm not a listener who wrote a comic. I'm a writer who sometimes listens to your show. What did you think of the comic?
I loved it. It's great.
Yeah, it sounded really good.
It is. West of Sundown came out earlier this year from Vault Comics. It was written by Aaron and Tim Seeley, art by Jim Terry, and color by Triona Farrell. It's good stuff. The Irish guy, that whole reason it came up was he's sort of the familiar slash ghoul of this vampire woman.
So that's the supernatural connection with the Confederate Irish guy.
Yes.
Okay, now I get it. All right.
Yeah, like he was out on the battlefield and I think he found her sleeping in the ground or something like that. I don't remember. I didn't study it because I wasn't planning on doing a full review of it, but it's good. It's really neat. And what kicks off the story is her haven gets burned down and she needs to go back to her where she was made a vampire to get Earth to be able to rest. Because it starts off in New York and then they go back to the Southwest or Mexico. I'm not sure. Because of the period. I recommend it. The art's beautiful. It's well-written, good story. I was totally interested the whole time. There's some cool cult stuff in there as well.
Ooh.
It's got it all.
You love cults.
I love cults.
I've been getting your book out, Cults of Cthulhu, here and there, because I didn't just sit down and read it when I got it right away. It's one of those every once. Because I was talking about the monster section in the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
Source book on the show this month, and I have your book right next to that one, and I pulled it out. Man, the art in there is so good.
So good.
Was it pretty thrilling to write an RPG and have like that level of art in it?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I was so excited to be able to like write something, and it's out in the ether, and you wonder how well do I communicate my ideas? And then when you see the artwork and it is exactly what you envisioned, and it's like, I guess I did something right. Because it looks exactly, I mean, all the characters look how I thought they were going to look. And it's just, it was great. It's such a cool experience. And Chad, you're in that book. You're one of the examples of the cult.
I've noticed this. Yeah.
It's you and Rachel and Andrew are making cults. And so I go through three different examples of making your own cult. And your cult is one of the best ones, so good job.
Thank you. Well, yeah, it is a Lovecraftian experience because as I open up the book, it's recounting things I've done that I don't remember.
Yeah.
I read Crime and Punishment earlier in the year by Fyodor Dostoevsky. There have been multiple references to Dostoevsky on the show recently, and I just suddenly thought, you know, maybe it's time. Maybe I'm old enough now that I should read The Russians. I'm disillusioned with life at this age, and this is maybe the time for me to take it on. That's the reason I asked you about the book and if it made you happy, because some of these things when you were in your early 20s, the idea of having a Chaosium book with full art in it would have blown your mind. But sometimes later, all of the effort it takes to get something like that done does sully it just a little bit, where you're just not as excited as you wish you could have been. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there's obviously because these things take time. So I wrote it in like 2016 and it didn't come out until a couple of years ago.
Right.
So I almost forgot about it. Really. Mike Mason kept me up to date when things were finally going, because it's a big company. They got a lot of projects. So they, you know, they have to, through the pipeline, things get moved around and all that stuff happens. So I was excited, especially when he started showing me artwork. And I was just, oh my God, this is so rad.
Yeah.
I think maybe what you're talking about is your capacity for joy as an adult, I think, is diminished. I don't think you can get as happy about things as you used to when you were young or when you were a kid.
Yeah, maybe those extremes just aren't as big because you've experienced more of life.
Like even if you said, you know what, you just won $10 million. I'd be like, wow, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I get it. Yeah.
You know?
Well, I do also think, though, that it's the amount of work that you put into it is it's not just like you, if you got cast suddenly, you know, Marvel called you and they're like, you're the new Speedball. You probably went to a few auditions, but it is a little like winning the lottery, you know?
Yeah.
Versus like the Time Capsule, my movie that came out, which is free now, by the way, all over the place on Tubi and YouTube. You know, the movie finally comes out and you're like, ugh, well, we got that done. You know, it's not like you imagine it, which would be this big. Or if I was younger, I might have been more excited about it. And some of it has to do with those years that went into it, compromises you made, et cetera, et cetera. I think that that's why, like, playing a rock show or being in theater, the product is made and consumed at the same time. So that's sort of like the best artistic experience you can have versus making a book or making a film or something like that, where there's a lot of lead up time and then the product comes out and it's just sort of like, meh, when it releases. Well, I got a new version of Crime and Punishment, or new-ish. You can get it for free, but the translation, I think, is from the early 20th century. And I went on Reddit and said, what's the best translation? Because I thought, if I'm going to get into this, I want to do it right. And there was a lot of debate, but the recommendation was the translation by Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokonsky. I think I'm pronouncing that right. That's a husband-wife team who do translations of these Russian novels. I didn't know anything about it going in, other than that title, but I didn't know what it was about. And I guess I was imagining something more like War and Peace, where there would be a lot of characters and I wouldn't know who they are. It would take place over a sweeping amount of time. Or maybe I was thinking about Dr. Zhivago or something. But it's not that at all. It's a really private psychological book.
Yeah.
TV Guide synopsis. It's about the mental anguish and moral dilemmas of Rodion Raskolnikov, an impoverished ex-student in St. Petersburg who plans to kill an unscrupulous pawnbroker, an old woman who stores money and valuable objects in her flat. He theorizes that with the money, he could liberate himself from poverty and go on to perform great deeds, and seeks to convince himself that certain crimes are justifiable if they're committed in order to remove obstacles to the higher goals of extraordinary men. Once the deed is done, however, he finds himself racked with confusion, paranoia, and disgust. His justifications lose their power as he struggles with guilt and horror. So it was like that.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it to feel as modern as it did, to be as psychological as it was, to be as personal. And I just found it to be not a difficult book to get through at all. And I was telling you about it. You picked up the graphic novel.
I did. Yeah. Well, I've been buying a lot of used books online now. You were telling me about Crime and Punishment. I was looking it up in the search. It popped up the graphic novel. This was the one adapted by David Zane Merowitz and the art by Elaine Korkos.
Okay.
That was published by Self-Made Hero, the guys that did Dead Beats.
I was thrilled when Dead Beats came out, Self-Made Hero. That was amazing to get that box of books. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was thrilled, too. It was great. It's the setting of it is modernized. So it looks like it's Russia maybe in the 80s or 90s because everything's all retro.
Sure.
But it doesn't actually alter the story in any way.
Yeah.
It's just visually. They said, you know, like I think in one of the places there's like a Sex Pistols poster behind them and there's other Russian things. And that's just a testament how good that book is.
Yes, definitely.
It feels totally modern.
The book was written in the 1860s. Mm. And so it was Tsarist Russia.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to have a pure experience with it, so I didn't read about the book and I didn't read about the author or do any of that stuff before I just went in and read the whole thing over time.
Yeah.
After I got done with it, it really affected me. I wanted to learn more about what might have motivated it. Dostoevsky was born in Moscow in 1821. In the 40s, he wrote his first novel, Poor Folk, which gained him entry into St. Petersburg literary circles. Now, I think he was younger and more idealistic at that time. Mm-hmm. However, he was arrested in 1849 for belonging to a literary group, the Petrashevsky Circle, that was discussing banned books that were critical of the Tsar. Mm-hmm. So he was sentenced to death. But the sentence was commuted at the last minute, and he spent 4 years in a Siberian prison camp.
Oh, my God.
Followed by 6 years of compulsory military service in exile.
Jeez.
Came back, and this is when he wrote his classics afterward. Now, that fake execution thing was crazy to me, and I wondered how that would affect you, right? Because you thought you were going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up a little more detail about it. Here's some info from Literary Hub. It says, on the day of the execution, Dostoevsky and 21 other members of the Petrashevsky Circle were forced to kneel, kiss the cross, then undergo a symbolic beheading where swords were broken above their heads. They were then tied to pillars in the town square and blindfolded, awaiting execution. But immediately before they were to be shot, an envoy from the Tsar arrived with the stay of execution, and the men were instead sentenced to 4 years of hard labor. It turns out this whole event was pre-planned. It really wasn't a pardon that came in at the last minute. The pardon had come the day before. This last-minute reversal of the execution, that was a purposeful act of psychological torture.
Wow.
designed to strike fear and then gratitude into the hearts of the Tsar's subjects.
Oh, my God.
Which is horrific. And I can't believe he went through that. So he wrote this book called The Idiot, and he used this experience in it. And forgive me for going on at length, but there was this quote about those last minutes. The prince is telling the story of a man who has 5 minutes left before an execution. It says, he said that those 5 minutes seemed to him an enormous wealth of time. He seemed to be living in these minutes so many lives that there was no need as yet to think of that last moment, so that he made several arrangements, dividing up the time into portions. One for saying farewell to his companions, 2 minutes for that. Then a couple more for thinking over his own life and career and all about himself. And another minute for a last look around. He remembered having divided his time like this quite well. While saying goodbye to his friends, he recollected asking one of them some very usual everyday question and being much interested in the answer. Then having bade farewell, he embarked upon those 2 minutes which he had allotted to looking into himself. He knew beforehand what he was going to think about. He wished to put it to himself as quickly and clearly as possible that here was he, a living, thinking man, and that in 3 minutes he would be nobody. Or if somebody or something, then what and where? He thought he would decide this question once for all in these last 3 minutes. A little way off, there stood a church, and its gilded spire glittered in the sun. He remembered staring stubbornly at the spire and at the rays of light sparkling from it. He could not tear his eyes from these rays of light. He got the idea that these rays were his new nature, and that in 3 minutes he would become one of them, amalgamated somehow with them. The repugnance to what must ensue almost immediately and the uncertainty were dreadful, he said, but worst of all was the idea, what should I do if I were not to die now? What if I were to return to life again? What an eternity of days, and all mine! How I should grudge and count up every minute of it, so as not to waste not a single instant. He said that this thought weighed so upon him and became such a terrible burden upon his brain that he could not bear it and wished they would shoot him quickly and have done with it. And that's the end of that excerpt. And it had that turn that was very funny to me.
Yeah, it's funny. I get it, too. That's what's so funny about it.
I know, exactly. Well, I've been hogging things. I'll come back around. I have another Dostoevsky quote, but let's get to it at the end. I want to hear about some of the other things that you're reading.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's this graphic novel, it's a series of graphic novels, but the first one is called Petite. It's by Hubert, illustrated by Bertrand Gagnon. Originally, it was written in French. It's all black and white, and it's a graphic novel. The art is almost Disney-like in its quality. It's just gorgeous. And it originally came out in 2014, but the story is something more like Game of Thrones. It's about a medieval Renaissance society that's ruled by giants and has been for hundreds of years. Giants live a very long time and not only enslave humans, but they eat them. So it's very graphic, this book. As the generations of giants come and go, they're getting smaller with each generation. The giants, you know, they're like 100 feet tall at their height, but right. Now they're more like 20 feet tall. And the queen gives birth to a human-sized baby and hides it from the other giants, and he's called Petite.
Oh, cool.
And it's just about his story of him growing up and then trying to figure out what to do, and then that maybe he's the savior of the giants, and should he really be saving the giants? Because they're pretty terrible. but it's really cool. The series is called the Ogre Gods series. There's 4 books in them. They jump around with different characters. Like there's a noble human that they follow. There's one book about one of the giants. There's one about a resistance fighter of the giants. They're just great, and they're put together in a way where it's you get like maybe a book of a comic book and then 2 or 3 pages of text that's just sort of illuminating the history, like you're reading an old book about the history of the world. So it kind of fills in some of the gaps, and it's the perfect length of those, because sometimes that extra stuff, sometimes with Alan Moore stuff, it's too much.
Sure.
You know, like some of his text just goes on for like 10 pages. I'm like, no, I want a graphic novel or a comic book here. I wasn't signing up.
I don't
want to
be interrupted and read a novel. Yeah, yes, that stuff bugs me. I usually skip it.
This is good. This is really good. It's succinct, and it gives you all the stuff that really builds this world. The art, again, is gorgeous. Just go online and look at it. It's called, the first one's Petite. There's 3 other books in the series. Highly recommend it.
How did you, what brought you around to, I mean, why did you find that?
I got it for a birthday present 10 years ago or something. And
oh, cool.
It went on the pile of books.
But basically, I love it when that happens, when something, you know, it sits there forever. And then finally one day you have that relationship with it.
Yeah. I don't know what why it made it back up to the top of the pile. I think maybe there was, maybe I saw something online about it. And I go, I have that actually. So I picked it up and gave it a real read and just was hooked. It was, it's really good. I think something I haven't heard much about, you know, in my circles of friends and stuff. So
in the Jack and the Beanstalk, that giant, he wants to be eaten up on some people.
Oh, yeah.
He smells the blood of an Englishman. That sounds really cool. I like, and it's also that idea that if they're eating people and then they're slowly evolving towards being people, there's a little bit of a conflict there.
Yeah.
Well, of becoming what you subjugate.
Oh, yeah. It feels like it's an allegory for the ruling class or nobility and how it just sort of, because they're all inbred. The giants have to be inbred. So that's part of their problem. And this degradation of them. There's like a point in ancient history, some of the giants were actually really nice and benevolent, and they didn't go to eating people and doing terrible stuff until later on. And it's just neat. Just really cool. I highly recommend it.
We were talking about the dueling Truman Capote movies when we were covering Miriam. And I remember seeing one of the trailers for them, and Daniel Craig was playing the criminal and Capote's there interviewing him. And I thought, I got to read this book at some point.
Yeah.
Just seems like it's one of those books. And here, what, 15 years later, I finally picked up In Cold Blood because I enjoyed Miriam and the writing so much. And as you might expect, it was good. It was very upsetting. I can see why people like it. I can see why it was such a sensation in the 60s.
Right.
I'm not going to recount the events of it because I think folks kind of have an idea of what it is. But it really is the writing in it that is fantastic. It's such a tragedy that he didn't knock out, you know, 10 or 20 more books.
Yeah.
Here, I'll read from the last paragraph of the very first chapter called The Last to See Them Alive. Here's an excerpt that got me really hooked into the book. At the time, not a soul in Sleeping Holcomb heard them. Four shotgun blasts that, all told, ended six human lives. But afterward, the townspeople, theretofore sufficiently unfearful of each other to seldom trouble to lock their doors, found fantasy, recreating them over and over again. Those somber explosions that stimulated fires of mistrust and the glare, of which many old neighbors viewed each other strangely and as strangers. This guy knows how to put a sentence together. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So that's a good one I can recommend. big revelation there.
On the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I don't listen to podcasts hardly at all anymore. It's sort of a busman's holiday for me, as they say here. You know, you don't want to go ride the bus when you're on vacation. You want to do something else.
Yes.
So I've been listening to audiobooks, and I don't want things that are too good because I'm doing other things while I listen to them.
Right.
So I've delved into the world of Star Wars: The High Republic, which is a sub-franchise of Star Wars taking place around 350 years before A New Hope. So it's the height of the Jedi Order. There's no Sith about. The main bad guys in these are some space pirates called the Nihil. It's also a golden age of the Republic, so the government like works, and people are generally pretty happy with it. And the whole thing starts off with this hyperspace accident that causes some ship wreckage to fall on this planet and cause a environmental catastrophe. And it's just about how the Republic jumps to and fixes it, and everybody's working together, and all the Jedis are doing cool Jedi stuff, and it's pretty light fare, obviously, and the writing is better sometimes than others, but it's something, it's a very comfort food for me. It was a very safe place to go. One of the things that I do like about it that I thought was interesting are these antagonists that are called the Path of the Open Hand, who think that the Jedi are force perverts, basically. So they believe in the force, but they think the Jedi are doing messed up stuff with the force. Like the force has a natural flow, and by them altering it, that they're doing the wrong thing. From a philosophical standpoint, it's neat to have all of these other religions in the Star Wars universe, because obviously the force is a demonstrable thing in there. People can do things that you can't do with technology because of this magic stuff. But to have these antagonists that put up a pretty good argument, unfortunately, you know, spoiler, they're controlled by an evil person that's, you know, manipulating them to get what they want, which kind of undercut how cool it was that the philosophy behind it, I thought, was neat. That it would be cool to have these people pushing up against the Jedi in a way that's not like we're just evil puppet masters. We really think what you're doing is just inherently wrong. It's not the way things are meant to be.
They have a point of view.
They had a point of view, yeah. And I thought it was really cool.
That's always better for a villain or a set of villains if they have a point of view that even if you don't agree with it, you can understand it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I actually have a paragraph from In Cold Blood. This is weird because he talks about force perverts. It starts... No, I'm kidding. Just read a long Truman Capote paragraph about force perverts.
They don't call them force perverts in the book, but...
That's not canon.
That's not canon, but they are. They are calling them force perverts, basically.
I buy used books as well, and that's actually where I... It's funny because I get a lot of gifts for people at the used bookstore because I think I'd rather give you something and say, here's something you can read that I think you would enjoy rather than a tchotchke because I know you like chickens. I'm going to buy you another chicken for your kitchen or whatever. You know what I mean? But sometimes those used books have like a coffee stain on them or something that until you give it, you're like, oh, this thing's kind of messed up.
I love him like that.
I didn't know what to get my nephew Ryan because he has read, and I'm sure the book that you're talking about, he's read. I'm sure of it. You know, he's just got this huge collection of Star Wars books. And so I thought I'm going to take a chance on some science fiction that's maybe adjacent to that. Yeah. There's a book called The Forever War by Joe Haldeman that people have said for years, you should read this. In fact, when we were taking the time capsule around my movie, which has time dilation in it, people brought it up in meetings. The Better Read executives were like, you should check out The Forever War because it has been around. It was published in 1974 in the Vietnam era, but it has some time dilation in it in terms of these soldiers having to come home and the world has, you know, hundreds of years have passed. Since they left. And so it was sort of that Vietnam Betts alienation of coming home and everything seeming different, but really magnified. Although I'm still only in the first third of the book, the tech is really interesting in it. It's so dangerous. In short, it's a military science fiction novel telling the contemplative story about human soldiers fighting an interstellar war against an alien civilization known as the Torrens. It won the Nebula Award in 75 and the Hugo and Locus Awards in 76. It's worth the acclaim so far. It's a real page turner, and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah.
I bought a copy for myself and one for Ryan, so hopefully he reads it too. But folks, if you're looking for some good sci-fi, I can recommend it.
I picked it up as well, used book shop online, which, again, I love it. It smells great because I think it's from 74.
Awesome.
Rachel forgot her book when we went on a trip and was like, oh, can I? Because I was going to read it. And she goes, oh, can I read that? Because I had a couple books with me. And I go, oh, yeah, sure. And she's still reading it. She snatched it. So I haven't had a chance to read it yet because she's been into it. So I guess it's pretty good.
It's one of those things where, you know, all of the war is happening in like 1997. And, you know, because that's the future.
Yeah.
But and it's got things that I think are supposed to wow you, like that there are both men and women in the military.
right. Yeah.
But there is stuff that does freak me out in it. And I think there's a pull quote on the cover of it from William Gibson, author of Neuromancer, that says, it's faint praise to say this is the best science fiction war novel. This is as good a war novel as you can get. So now I was also going to say a movie that Dan Pratt, our listener and friend, kept bugging me to watch, Lake Mungo, which is an Australian horror film from 2008. And it looked okay, but it's from that era when there was sort of a glut of found footage movies post Paranormal Activity.
Right.
And I think I just kind of lumped it in with that stuff. Well, I finally got around to watching it, and it was scary.
Oh, rad.
And a bit of a weird tale.
Oh.
It feels a little a piece of what you would see on streaming in terms of true crime. It's got a mockumentary style where they're interviewing people, and they even do little reenactments of things that they're talking about. So it seems very real. The actors are amazing. I mean, they really pull it off. It had a kind of a strange, mind-bending twist in the plot that I didn't expect, and it gave me goosebumps a couple of times, like actual physical goosebumps. So could be that I watched it at like 2 a.m., you know. I probably hyped it too much, but check out Lake Mungo.
Well, I've been, like everybody else in the entire world, been watching The Bear.
Yes.
Which is called a comedy drama series, but I think the comedy part is mostly just nervous laughing.
Yeah, it's intense.
It came out originally last year on Hulu, but it's on Disney Plus here in the UK. It's in its second season. It's basically about a guy who is a world-renowned chef, comes back to Chicago to take over his family's sandwich shop after his older brother dies.
Oh, is that show set in Chicago?
Well, it's one of these shows that's so intense, but it's just people making food, and yet somehow... it is like when if you really just think about what's going on, they're just people making food, And yeah. yet it feels like some of the worst situations I've ever been in my life.
Oh, there is the episode, and I think it's the penultimate one in the first season, where the order system breaks and the sandwich orders keep coming in.
Oh, my God.
And the whole, you know, the staff is, and all the relationships are falling apart. It's a great episode of a horror. I mean, it feels like horror. It yeah. hits all the things that a good horror movie would do.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a terrifying episode of television. Oh. Yeah. I really like the bear. I do have to say, you and I have been having this conversation about celebrities and movie stars.
Yes.
And I know we only half mean it, but we're trying to make a rule where once you're in a part, you don't get to act anymore.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because I get tired of celebrities. I'm just tired of them. I turn on the TV. I'm like, oh, what do you know? Cate Blanchett made another movie. You just see the same people over and over and over again. And they're all good and they deserve it. But I'm so tired of it. The Bear I liked because even though I recognized a couple of the actors, mm-hmm. one of the guys in Andor,
yeah.
but he's been around forever. I kind of recognized them, but they're jobbing actors. And so they very quickly became those characters.
Right.
And then it was a huge hit in the first season. In the second season, it's like they just backed up a celebrity truck and opened it up and went, you know, we're a big hit now. So here comes Jamie Lee Curtis and Bob Odenkirk yeah. and John Mulaney and Jillian Jacobs and anyone else who ever lived in Chicago who's an actor. Sarah Paulson, get them in here.
Yeah.
And I was really disappointed in that, even though they were all good.
Boy, that family, speaking of the Jamie Lee Curtis and Bob Odenkirk, that episode where they have a family dinner.
Oh, my God.
Christmas. Jeez. Oh, my God. That's like one of the worst horror films I've ever seen. The tension was uh-huh. insane. Like, I had to stop watching it because I go, Rachel, I can't do this right now. It's too much.
It's too much. Yeah.
And she said, oh, yeah, okay, I agree. And so we had to come back and finish it later. But yeah. I'm saying these things. It's good, though. It's so compelling. And the characters are so interesting. And you do care. And it's about trauma and anxiety and family and how triggering family is for all of that stuff. And oh yeah. gosh.
The next two episodes are sugary sweet as a reward for getting through that.
Oh, good. good.
They will make you feel really, really good. The next two.
All right.
And it's a total payback.
Excellent.
But yeah, the bear, the main character Carmine had said at some point, something that I articulated earlier in this episode, where it's like, you work so hard for this. He won an award, or he got the Michelin stars or whatever for his restaurant. And he's like, there's no time to experience the joy of it.
Yeah.
And I don't even know why I'm doing this. Like, he's pursuing this perfection and this excellence, but can't enjoy a second of it.
Yeah.
And the show kind of deconstructs why something like that might occur. It's really good. Well, what else? We're running out of time here.
I would say, I don't know if I brought it up before, but Into the Woods by John York. Have we talked about it?
I don't think so.
No, it's Penguin Press. It's the subtitle of the book is How Stories Work and Why We Tell Them. And it breaks down just a lot of story structure stuff, mm-hmm. a lot of filmmaking, but it also looks at how other people who've written about story structure write about story structure. So it's a little meta in that way.
Cool.
But it's just a real like breezy read and interesting. I recommend it. It's been around for a long time, and I think some other writer recommended it to me.
I thought it was Into the Woods by Tom York from Radiohead. I'm like, he's doing a cover of the Sondheim Into the Woods.
Oh, wow.
That would be a very interesting soundtrack.
That would be. A role-playing game. We haven't talked about any role-playing games. One yes. that I just was reading. It's a slightly older game called The Spire. It takes place in a giant tower/skyscraper, and you play dark elves caught up in a rebellion against the high elves at the top of the tower. It's just bonkers. The artwork is gorgeous. It's really neat, very stylized. But there's technology, so it's sort of fantasy, but it's not. And you don't really get an explanation of why everybody just lives in this gigantic skyscraper.
Like, right.
Just the further down you go in the tower, the more messed up things get. And so people just don't go down to the lower levels of the tower.
It's so interesting that this game and then the petite... There yeah. are these like fantasy social order dramas.
Yeah, I guess I'm into that.
Speaking of, I read the first chapter or two of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Oh, right.
But I put it aside because I do think we're going to cover that on the show.
I think we should.
At some point. And I also got a copy of War of the Worlds because I've never read it.
Nope, me neither.
And I know we're going to cover that at some point, although we have just recently done H.G. Wells. So yeah, not soon.
Next year.
But yeah, next year we'll definitely next get into year. It. Well, I have this quote from Dostoevsky that I wanted to read. If
sure.
you have anything else, tell me. Otherwise, I'm going to go out on this. Back to Dostoevsky, I'll read this quote, which really impressed me. This is from Notes from the Underground, which actually is a more autobiographical depiction of his time in prison or in exile in Siberia. You know, after that experience, like I said, he was a little more idealistic in his youth. And after that experience, he started to think, you know, I think people just have suffering in the blood, that we're going to do it to ourselves anyway. So many people are wasting their lives searching for utopia. Things can get better, but things will never be perfect. You know, we were talking about, we had some of these questions while we were covering The Future is Female. I think it was that story, Miracle of the Lily, that went on and on, where things did reach utopia state, but then people kind of screwed it up because, like, what are you supposed to do with that time when you have everything working great for you?
Well, and the time machine as well.
And the time machine as well. So this was from Notes of the Underground by Dostoevsky. This is what he has to say. One may say anything about the history of the world, anything that might enter the most disordered imagination. The only thing one can't say is that it's rational. The very word sticks in one's throat. And indeed, this is the odd thing that is continually happening. There are continually turning up in life moral and rational persons, sages and lovers of humanity, who make it their object to live all their lives as morally and rationally as possible, to be, so to speak, a light to their neighbors, simply in order to show them that it is possible to live morally and rationally in this world. And yet we all know that those very people sooner or later have been false to themselves, playing some queer trick, often a most unseemly one. Now I ask you, what can be expected of man since he is a being endowed with strange qualities? Shower upon him every earthly blessing. Drown him in a sea of happiness, so that nothing but bubbles of bliss can be seen on the surface. Give him economic prosperity, such that he should have nothing else to do but sleep, eat cakes, and busy himself in the continuation of his species. And even then, out of sheer ingratitude, sheer spite, man would play you some nasty trick. He would even risk his cakes, and would deliberately desire the most fatal rubbish, the most uneconomical absurdity, simply to introduce into all this positive good sense his fatal, fantastic element. It is just his fantastic dreams, his vulgar folly, that he will desire to retain, simply in order to prove to himself, as though that were so necessary, that men still are men, and not the keys of a piano, which the laws of nature threaten to control so completely that soon one will be able to desire nothing but by the calendar. And that is not all. Even if man really were nothing but a piano key, even if this were proved to him by natural science and mathematics, even then he would not become reasonable, but would purposely do something perverse out of simple ingratitude, simply to gain his point. And if he does not find means, he will contrive destruction and chaos, will contrive sufferings of all sorts only to gain his point. He will launch a curse upon the world, and as only man can curse, it is his privilege, the primary distinction between him and other animals. Maybe his curse alone, he will attain this object. That is, convince himself that he is a man and not a piano key. If you say that all this, too, can be calculated and tabulated, chaos and darkness and curses, so that the mere possibility of calculating it all beforehand would stop it all and reason would reassert itself, then man would purposely go mad in order to be rid of reason and gain his point. I believe in it. I answer for it. The whole work of man really seems to consist in nothing but proving to himself every minute that he is a man and not a piano key. It may be at the cost of his skin. It may be by cannibalism. And this being so, can one help being tempted to rejoice that it has not yet come off and that desire still depends on something we don't know? What do you think of that?
I don't agree with it. No, I absolutely agree with it. And yeah, I mean, just look at the news. Just look at political actions that are taking place all over the world. Look at, you know, who we elect.
Right.
Who are these politicians that get in power? It's just nuts to me that the people that vote for these people see them in power and go, oh, yeah, they're doing a pretty good job. It's like madness.
Well, I think it just seems so modern, too, this whole we're not a piano key when we're talking about AI and rationalism and trying to use these tools. Will humans at some point go, how dare you work everything out for me? I'm going to burn it all down just to show you I can.
Yeah, I hope not. I'm still of the religion of the Star Trek utopia that will someday transpire. I don't think it will, because of pretty much everything that you just read there.
Well, there, that seems to apply directly to Star Trek, though, because how many times does the Vulcan logic make so much more sense than whatever Kirk comes up with? But he's asserting his humanity.
Yeah.
He's the definition of that. I'm not a piano key. I'm Kirk.
Yeah.
Let's do the human thing, which is unreasonable, just to show that we can.
And then it works.
And then it works.
It works, yeah. Pretty nutty stuff. And yeah, obviously, Dostoevsky was amazing. Well, I want to thank all of you guys for subscribing at the level you do, because this extra stuff is just for you.
It is. This rambling, long discussion about things we're reading this summer. We're going to be back next month with some science fiction, which I'm looking forward to. Haven't worked out exactly what it's going to be, but yeah. Hope we'll have you there for that as well. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Extra credit, exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.